just think it's an impossible thing to talk about without sounding totally cliched, but it is about family, it's about people ultimately. It's about feeling safe. It's about feeling safe to be the person that you want to be in your home, to be vulnerable, intimate, to take risks, to have a laugh, to have fun, to do the things that you like doing, to be with your kids, do the stuff that you like doing. Yeah, and wherever I've lived, I've felt like that. Even when those homes weren't ours and weren't decorated, they've always had that feeling.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Homing In. I'm Matt Gibbard, co-founder of The Modern House. My guest today is Claudia Donaldson. Claudia was the photography director at Wallpaper Magazine before becoming editor-in-chief of Nowness, which was the video platform that revolutionised the way we consume art and culture. Under her stewardship, Nowness became well known for its In-Residence series, which took us inside the homes of the biggest names in design and architecture. More latterly, she founded her own print magazine and digital platform, Cloakroom. It launched with a brilliant cover story on Harrison Ford by her husband Matthew Donaldson, who's a photographer and filmmaker. Today I've come to visit Claudia at her beautiful home in London. She tells me about what it was like to grow up in an English prototype of the American dream and talks fondly about her impossibly glamorous grandparents' house, which had shag pile carpet, pink loo roll and a telephone next to the sunken bath. We discuss why she prefers to define space with furniture rather than architecture, what happened when she broke her hip and couldn't get down the stairs, why a home is never truly finished, and the power of procrastination. So here it is, Claudia Donaldson in residence, getting a taste of her own journalistic medicine. Happy listening, hope you enjoy it. Tell me about where you grew up. You grew up in a flat in Herger Court in Harrow-on-the-Hill, which is, I did have a little look at it, it's a 1930s building designed by a guy called Josiah Gunton and his son William. But what was it like? Tell me what it was like.
I think it's a really interesting project. The block of flats were built at a time, you know, if you think about Victorian times in London, the physical context of it is really interesting. And if you think of a place like Harrow, on the hill was where you wanted to live, out of the smell, out of the smog, where the air is clean, where there's good drainage. So the Victorians started building quite grand villas. It was an affluent area. Then you fast forward to the sort of late 20s, early 30s. And yeah, it was a really optimistic time and a time for a new way of living that was reflected architecturally. And the flat that I lived in was a really big flat. The flats were really spacious in a series of blocks. There were four blocks, lots of light, set within parkland trees. Our flat was north facing, looking over a tennis court. There was a swimming pool when it was built, squash courts, porters. It's just a very kind of Agatha Christie world of styling, and built as a sort of suburban utopia where quality of living was made accessible for people. It was the sort of idea of the nuclear family. Dad comes home with a parcel at the end of the day. Mum's wearing a pinny. A sort of not that happened in my house because both my parents were working, but you know, a sort of English prototype, I guess, of the American dream. I grew up among lots of other families with kids my age. So during the summer holidays, we were outside all day. Often our parents would be outside. My mum slathered in ombre solaire, tanning oil, drinking gin and tonics with her friends, and we were running wild. You know, it was a kind of dream scenario, and really it's a middle class thing. And I really loved living there. It's been really nice just thinking back to that time. I'm not a particularly nostalgic person, but actually my childhood there was extremely happy. We had that thing where we just were literally bored to tears, and we'd come up with things like the Herger Olympics, and because there were so many children there, we were sort of bored in a gang.
Sounds idyllic.
Yeah, it really was. And the proximity to London is another really interesting part of it, that the sort of where it's located, you have these kind of panoramic steep views into You can see Wembley and beyond that. And when I was a teenager and I started going out, there was something really lovely about being able to get into town to go clubbing or go out in central London and then just hop on the Metropolitan line, then be at home, and it's in a sort of semi-rural landscape, which is actually really incredibly peaceful. So I spent a lot of my teenage years and early 20s being quite dismissive about living in the suburbs, but I do actually really enjoy it, and I don't think it's an accident that we've ended up living where we live. It's not classed as suburban London. Willesden Green isn't suburban London, but we live on a tree-lined street. It's really quiet. The neighbours know each other. I think I absorb that, and actually it's my default place.
So do you think you could live somewhere that was more isolated, or would you miss that community element?
I don't know. We're thinking about that at the moment. It's something that we talk about a lot. I don't know is the short answer. We've got kids who, they're teenage. Our daughter loves the idea of being in the countryside, and our son doesn't, and they're at school in London. But I like the idea of being somewhere that makes London accessible. I have friends who live in the Chilterns, and it's great to be able to go to work in London and then be at home and leave the kitchen door open and potter around, particularly in the summer.
So you said that both of your parents were working. What is it that they were doing?
They were both quite, my family are quite entrepreneurial, certainly on my mother's side. My mum set up a chain of sandwich bars called Upper Crust, not the black and yellow ones in the mainline train stations. She set this up in the 80s because she was bored. She started a playgroup and then met another woman, and they decided to open a sandwich bar in Harrow. And it had a really good, I wish I bought it to show you, that it had a brilliant graphic identity. They made a crest, which was a cow on one side and a sheep on the other, holding a sort of a sandwich cut into four. And the colour scheme was red, white and blue. And it was really successful. They opened one in a sort of side street off the main town centre in Harrow, and then ended up opening six more shops, one of which was opened by Princess Diana.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
If you're going to call it Upper Crust.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So my dad worked in the restaurant business. He came to London when he was 17. My godfather had a restaurant called Mimo Dischia in Belgravia. And growing up, he managed restaurants, and we would spend a lot of time at Mimo's, which at the time in the 80s, it was San Lorenzo and Mimo Dischia, and the great and the good were there. Just people like, I don't know, Julie Andrews and Sylvester Stallone and all those kind of 80s stars, Andrew Lloyd Webber. And the kids would hang out in the restaurant. We were culturally, I was brought up in a really Italian way.
That's interesting. Because you and Matthew, your husband, I don't know about you, but I know that Matthew spends a lot of time at the River Cafe, doesn't he? Do you as well?
No. I wish I did.
He got on his own, yeah. But that's interesting because that's that sort of thing, isn't it?
I guess so. I've never really thought of that, actually. We met Ruthie because I stalked her because I wanted to make a film with her and Richard for a series that Matthew and I created, actually, at Nowness, which was a media channel then owned by LVMH. And we launched this series called In Residence, which was basically a sort of a house tour, but a sort of really intimate conversation with designers and architects, mostly because we couldn't find anything that we wanted to watch online that wasn't project-based and that was accessible, that was relatable. And I sent her several emails, and in the end she said, come and see me. And we basically fell in love and became great friends. Yeah, and just going back to what you were saying about that influence culturally, you know, I was thinking about the design aspect of how I grew up and what I absorbed from my parents. We didn't talk about design when I grew up. I got that from my grandparents on my maternal side. My dad was from a rural farming family, but loved to cook. So our kitchen was full of incredible gadgets, pasta machines. We often had fresh pasta drying out, drawers open so that sort of tagliatelle could dry amongst the drawers. And you know, he had this kind of what looked like a kind of meat mincer that he used to put potatoes in. And there was always a sort of a kitchen drama going on, which I think my dad elicited. And I guess the culture and objects in our kitchen was really the only kind of design that we had in our home. It was pretty basic.
What was your bedroom like?
Tidy.
Is that you as a character?
Less so now, but I was tidy. My mum was pretty strict about that kind of stuff. She worked really hard. And I relate to that thing of having your surroundings being tidy, having a tidy desk. Like if I start a project or a piece of work, I just automatically arrange my desk in a certain way. There's nothing too significant to share about what my bedroom looked like, other than I remember peering out the window quite a lot. There was a lot of green space, yeah.
Wanting to be outside.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time outside.
So how would you characterise yourself as a child? Mischievous, full of life, what were you like?
I went to trouble quite a lot. Yeah, I was naughty. I got expelled from school.
Did you do?
I think it was in a sort of a cumulative expulsion. But I was at a convent school, and I think there's a number of times that you could be sent to say the rosary, sort of the Hail Marys and Our Fathers outside Sister Alphonsus's office, and I was found there once too often. I learned very quickly that making people laugh when I was 13, 14 made me feel great, so I kept doing it, even though I got into lots of trouble. And then I had a kind of really about turn when I went to my next school and became quite square and nerdy. And I think it was because it was a much smaller school, much smaller classrooms. I think I was just overwhelmed by the size of the school that I was in previously. Yeah, I was naughty, but I enjoyed school. I really liked learning. I liked most of my teachers. And it wasn't until I was in the sixth form where I sort of broke away from my friends, because they were pretty slony, and I wasn't really interested in being in couples and going to the local pub and hosting dinner parties. I wanted to be in a club, and I wanted to dance, and I wanted to wear different clothes. And so the end of my school life was about breaking away, really.
What have you been dressed in around that time?
My mum used to call them pelmets, like a very tight short skirt that barely covered my pants. Usually a sort of pair of Timberland boots with a hoodie. That was a sort of...
With the short skirt?
With the short skirt.
Wow, that's quite a look.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your grandparents, and was it your maternal grandparents whose home you wanted to talk about in Kite Hill?
Yeah, their home was called Kite Hill, and it was...
Oh, it's called Kite Hill.
Yeah, it was a bungalow in Tadworth in Surrey, in a place that was, again, really interesting geographically. It was woody and foresty, and its location was really compelling to me as a child. And again, I wasn't very aware of it at the time. It was just a feeling of driving up to their house, and you'd go in the driveway, which was set back from a road, and quite a windy gravel drive, and through a thicket of rhododendron and ferns and a very shady plot. And the thing that I remember about it, the front of, I don't know which way it faced, but it was always in dappled light when you arrived. And it reminded me a bit of the house that Patrick Gwynne built, the Homewood in Surrey, in a similar part of England, not Corbusier-ish or Mies van der Rohe in its kind of architecturally, in the way that house had stilts to, and they parked their cars underneath. It was a similar sort of setup in my grandparents' house. And I remember things like the stairs up to the front door were really wide and really shallow, and the front door was really wide, and it was a really beautiful colour. It was a sort of teal blue colour, and it had a really satisfying door knocker on it. And my grandmother was French, and she was really unlike my friends' grannies. She never came and watched me in anything. She never took me out for tea. We were really close, but it was always in her environment. She was slim and glamorous, and was usually in the summer she'd be wearing a bikini or with a kind of a gauloise and a jubbonet in her hand, and always wore those long floaty Indian skirts and lots of amazing jewellery, and she was very glamorous. And my grandfather was Scottish, and their house was on one level, the sort of, I'm going to call it the south side of the house, was sort of glazed and overlooked a fantastic garden. She loved gardening, so had beautiful, just a very well manicured lawn, and had a huge pond in it, but had this sort of, it was designed in a way where there was almost like sunken rooms at the back of the garden, pathways, and where there was a greenhouse, and just always stuff in the greenhouse, always a bit dilapidated. And there was an amazing tree in the garden, a cypress tree that was hollow inside. And I remember going in there with my brother. She had pink loo paper, which we always thought was so cool. Yeah. And we'd take tons of loo paper and decorate the inside. And she'd bring us cushions so we could sit down in the tree and bring us... She always had a goodie box full of Twix biscuits. So we'd sit in there and eat Twix biscuits. And my grandfather, she also had this... They had this incredible bathroom that adjoined their bedroom. So they had an ensuite bathroom, which I just thought was so impossibly glamorous, with a sunken bath in it, kind of purple, with a telephone next to it. Again, with floor-to-ceiling... a glazed wall, so I could ring my mum from the bath, probably not my mum actually, probably my friend, and look out of the window. It was just, and shag pile carpet, yeah, it's just thrilling. They had a kind of deep understanding for texture in that house that was, my grandmother would buy junk furniture and upholster it herself. And they had a spare room, and you'd have the odd good piece of furniture, but quite a lot of junk, brown junk furniture that would just have a sort of a bit of flesh-coloured raw silk with a sort of a heavy turquoise damask with a little bit of leopard print. And again, they didn't talk about design. They had great things, and they weren't constantly buying things. They weren't distracted by contemporary design like so many people are. It was just a great balance of cozy, and it looked great, and I think I really absorbed that from the time that I spent there. And there was also always lots of food, and my grandmother loved to cook. She's a bit like me, she's always in the kitchen sort of smoking fags and like preparing stuff and leaving everybody else to it, you know, kind of happier there.
That's interesting. Would you characterise yourself as an outsider in a way? Is that how you see yourself?
Yeah, I do actually. And I always have done. And for a long time, I felt that like that at work. In my work life, I get to places where there seems to be a sort of rebuild or an overhaul or a new direction. And that was definitely my experience when I got to Wallpaper Magazine. It was post Tyler Brulé, and My job was to redefine the magazine visually through the photographic commissioning strategy. I was the photo director there and a senior commissioning editor there. And my hobby was collecting photography books. So I was really lucky because there was money then. So I got to commission people whose books I'd been collecting. I got to get people from the art world to come in and commission them to do travel stories, and I'd get to fuck things up, basically do things that actually today are not that a fairly standard kind of practice in magazine publishing, but getting fashion photographers to do architecture stories. And just, I think I definitely ruffled some feathers, and also having been at newspapers before that, I was used to doing things really quickly. And I got to Wallpaper, and there'd be 25 meetings to decide how to photograph that glass. So it was definitely, there was a period of like meeting in the middle. And then when I got to Nowness, I arrived, Jefferson Hatt asked me to work with him. And for anyone who's listening who doesn't know who he is, he's a indie publisher and has a magazine called Dazed and Confused, is the founder of that and another magazine, and was LVMH, this is 15 years ago, said who's the best person in fashion to launch a media brand for LVMH, and they chose Jefferson wisely, in my opinion, and he then appointed me as editor-in-chief, and we together we worked and built a team and relaunched Nowness from essentially a fashion blog that turned arts and culture blog to a video channel. And the not the imposter, because I didn't feel like an imposter, but the being on the outside of fashion, architecture, design. So I brought a lot of the work and the stuff that I felt passionate about at Wallpaper to, we didn't have a design audience. So I convinced Jefferson to allow me to build an audience in design, because back then people started talking about becoming that the sort of collective obsession with the space that surrounds you, your interior environment. So we launched In Residence, and you know, I really enjoyed that, the sort of dismantling that idea of rivalry between magazines, and that idea of the exclusive just became less and less relevant and important, and actually a landscape for all of us to be in. So, you know, I loved at the time Appartamento magazine, and I felt like they were expert in that kind of vernacular storytelling and photography and style, and just thought, why don't we join forces and launch a video series where we're good at making video, we're great at the sort of the filmic aspect of it, and they bring the talent. And so we did that. We launched a series called My Appartamento. So yeah, and going to fashion shows, depending on who our relationship was with at the time, I'd sometimes find myself in a front row seat next to a fashion magazine editor at a Prada show, and definitely felt like didn't really want to be there. It was there's a discomfort to that, but also a massive learning and actually a freedom being on the outside looking in.
Can you pinpoint whether that's always been there, that feeling? Was that there as a child then, that feeling of being an outsider?
Not really. I think that kind of started when I got to university and I just wasn't doing the same as everybody else. All my friends were doing history of art and were in the Sainsbury Centre at UEA. And I was doing French literature. I wasn't friends with anyone on my course, and I loved my course. I just think it's a bit like what we were talking about earlier. It's a bit like following a brief. My instinct, my default is to, in work and life, is to be invited or asked to do something or told to do something. And I end up either deliberately being rebellious, just getting a bit of a kick out of it, or just ending up doing just like completely ignoring the brief, which is how Cloakroom happened, the magazine and creative agency that I started after Nowness. It was born from a conversation with Jefferson about doing a design magazine as part of the Dazed Media stable, and ending up not following a brief and ending up with something that I really believed in, actually. And he was brilliant. He just said, go and do it, go and publish it, and don't get someone else to publish it, do it yourself. Which at the time I thought was the absolutely bonkers idea. It was impossible, I wasn't going to do it. And then a year later I did it.
Just a quick one. I'm really pleased to say that this podcast is sponsored by one of my all-time favourite brands, Vitsu. Over the past 25 years or so, I've been very lucky to visit hundreds of beautifully designed living spaces. And if I could name one product that I've seen more than any other, it would have to be the 606 Universal Shelving System from Vitsu. I think the reason that so many people from the creative industries live with Vitsu shelving is because it's so incredibly versatile, both functionally and visually. It works in big spaces and small ones, modern places, traditional places, townhouses and country houses. And the key to its success, I think, is that it's been paired back to its absolute essentials. Dieter Rams, who conceived it back in 1960, famously said that good design is as little design as possible. And I couldn't agree more with that. To find out more about this brilliant product, you can visit vitsoe.com. That's vitsoe.com. Right, back to the podcast.
Well, that brings us nicely on to present day. You touched on what you're doing professionally now, but as we stand today, what does your week look like? What does your day-to-day look like?
It's a really good question in a kind of thinking about it in a longer term. I don't know.
And that's because cloakroom is no longer your thing? Or tell us about cloakroom then.
Cloakroom, it just ended up being an accidental sort of CEO of a business. And it was brilliant because we produced four magazines. That was never my intention. We made some great things. We did some great projects. And my takeaway from it is that I don't want to run my own business.
Right.
And also, it made me really ask why I was doing it, because it's really difficult to... We set something up that was creatively and editorially very successfully, but commercially, it's really hard to make money out of a publishing business. It's hard enough for people with legacy and archive, like Condé Nast and Dazed even, to monetize. And actually, I felt like... on a personal level, if I looked at what I'd done, part of my frustrations at being an employee there were things at Wallpaper that I really didn't want to do, and I moaned about them while I was there. And then I got my own magazine, and I didn't have to do them anymore. Didn't have to do lifestyle pages. I made it commercially quite difficult for myself because I didn't want to have lots of advertisers, and I didn't want people to have to go through a raft of advertising to read a story. I wanted you to read the magazine in the same way that you'd enjoy an interview in The New Yorker. We used our budget to pay for really great writers. It wasn't just, you know, shapes and colours and a pretty magazine. So, yeah, it was really hard to make money out of it, and actually you have to really believe in what you're doing and really want to do it. And actually, when you'll know this better than anybody, when you're running a creative business, you actually spend most of your time not doing the bit that you perhaps thought that you would be doing. So I'm actually just pausing, and I broke my hip last year. So I spent the beginning of this year sort of immobile, which was actually really useful because it put me back in my body and just allowed a time of kind of perspective and reflection. And actually, I'd really like to learn something new.
So you were at mobile for, what, how long? For a couple of months?
Yeah.
I mean, that's full on, isn't it? Were you here at home or were you in hospital?
Yeah, I was at home. It was the end of a really shit year. We'd lost a really close friend, Maureen Doherty of Egg, who was such an important person in our lives, a mentor and godmother and surrogate mother and best friend, both to me and to Matthew and to our children. So just had a lot of grief and pause and universal things happening. And actually it feels, and turning 50 this year. So just like the sort of, just getting to a different point in life. And yeah, I spent a lot of time at home. I was very lucky. They all looked after me. They were brilliant. I read a lot of books. Watched a lot of telly.
Yeah. And we'll come on to... what an amazing house this is that you live in, and we're sitting in it now. But I suppose a question related to that is, did it give the house extra meaning in a way, sort of being tied to it, being in your bed, relying on it as quite a primal thing, which is like a nest, right? It's somewhere you have to be to convalesce and recover. How well did it perform that, and did it make you see it in a different way?
It made me have to change the way that I interact with the space and operate within the space. I had to totally let go of what was going on downstairs because I couldn't get downstairs. I got out of hospital on Christmas Eve, and we have this ritual of our friend Lee always comes about 10 days before Christmas, and she comes with Peter Miles, and they help us decorate the tree, and we've done that every year. And when I got home, the Christmas tree was in its netting on the floor and hadn't been decorated. And you know what? That's okay. My family came and got me. And on Christmas Day, Matthew actually drove. My mum was ill, and He was amazing, actually. He made Christmas lunch and drove it to my mum's on a silver tray, and then came back, and the kids and him had lunch, and I had lunch on a tray upstairs. It's just, you don't have a choice. You've got to surrender to what's going on. Yes, the way that I am in the space became a really important thing for me to look at and to have real acceptance around, actually.
Yeah, because before we started the podcast, you mentioned that you're kind of okay with things not being perfect. You're okay with a bit of clutter. You're okay with it not being immaculate at all times. Does Matthew agree on that? Because I'm always interested in the dynamic between people that live together. Is he more of a minimalist, or how does that work between the two of you?
He'd really roll his eyes if he heard the word minimalist. That's so funny. I don't know. We were having an argument once when we first... We were having a difference of opinion when we bought this house. And I remember we couldn't hear each other. We couldn't make each other understand our own points. And I drew a picture on a piece of paper. And he was I drew a square for him. And I drew a window with frilly curtains in it for me. And just the way that we like to live is quite similar, but how it, I guess being a photographer, how it photographs to him is important.
He sees it as a series of frames and set pieces almost.
I think he'd be happy to live in a room, in a fantastic kind of Regency corniced room with a great chair in it. Whereas I'm draping bits of paisley over the coffee table and getting cushions made. Yeah, but he really appreciates that. But I remember coming home with the plant in the sitting room, and I'd have to do things surreptitiously and just subtly get things in.
This sounds so familiar to me, Claudia, honestly. It's exactly the same as my relationship with Faye, actually, because I hugely admire what she does and we agree on most things, but yeah, there probably are areas where most days something will walk its way through the front door into the hallway, and there'll be something appeared yesterday. I've no idea what it is, some strange brown wooden object.
I think also, like, it's that thing of, again, this is something that I really appreciate as I get older. I'm actually really interested in decorating, and I know this because the conversations I have with friends of mine who are decorators are a little bit, I can really get into the nitty-gritty with them. The way things sound, the pleasingness of the way a door clicks shut, or the way a room sounds, the thud of a book on a table that's covered in fabric or not. It's just things like those kind of idiosyncratic things. A friend of mine's just moved into a cottage, and we talked for about 10 minutes about how she's sort of chamfered off, like removed the hard edges in the corners of her kitchen so all the walls are a little bit rounded. And I really appreciate details like that that I've absorbed through, particularly in my grandparents' house, that I actually am coming back to. So yeah, sure, it's great if it looks great, but it has to feel great and sound great too.
Well, these books are very useful, and this huge ottoman as well. It is a beautiful space, and it's particularly the kitchen. It's a very well photographed space. Certainly I've seen it a lot, because you've got a plain English kitchen, and they very much use it as a bit of a calling card, actually, because it's a really lovely combination of things. I think the materiality of it, the height, the top light that comes down, the dark green colour that you've used on the cupboards, I think is quite unusual. I love it. Tell me about that kitchen. What was the thinking behind it? What was the process? And how well does it work as a family kitchen?
I really want to say something clever, but the thing that is most significant about that kitchen was how it was built. I can't remember the name of the man that came in to build it, but he was in the army, and his dad was in the army, and it was just amazing to watch him come in every day. And the way that he laid out his tools and the conversations that he had with his co-worker, the sort of detail of just asking each other whether it should be 0.2 mil and just the precision of it made me feel really lucky that there were people who were just really expert at what they do. It was a real thrill to have that going on.
Yeah, and
some of it works and some of it doesn't work. Like the pantry that we built is actually the source of the underfloor heating in the hottest room in the house. So it's absolutely useless.
Yeah, it's good for boiling ham.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. And the other thing is you've got these glazed crittle windows giving onto the garden, which actually you were very early adopters of that idea, and since quite a few people have done it, haven't they? But what was the thinking in this area as well?
Just get as much space as we can. It's north facing, so get as much light in as we can. We live in this space, and I don't know why we chose crittle, probably because we liked it. And actually, I grew up with crittle. I grew up in, you know, the 1930s crittle windows. I like them. Yeah, lots of people use them. I don't know if I'd do it again. Probably not. Probably I'm quite fickle. I like changing. I'm constantly changing and rearranging. It drives Matthew mad. I like changing furniture around. I like moving stuff and playing with space.
But this is such a great flow of spaces because the kitchen is connected to the dining area, it's connected to where we are, the sitting area. And then up a couple of steps, you've got some doors onto at the front. What's presumably more of an evening sitting room, is it? Cosier. Is that where you get, or do you just
Oh my God,
it?
That's so grand.
No, but,
yeah,
no,
it
not.
Is. It's hilariously grand because basically that room we called the sort of clairvoyant / really bad therapist room because it's just had so many kind of iterations. It's had a table there that I've tried to make it into a sort of study. It's now got really comfy deep seated sofas in it and a telly, and yeah, it's a room to watch the telly in. Yeah, it is a sitting room that we go to in the evening, but no one ever sits in there apart from us. We have to beg our children to sit in there with us. I remember as sort of growing up, you know, my parents were always asking us not to watch telly, and now we're sort of begging them to watch television with us, you know.
It's interesting. How old are your kids?
They're 11 and 15. I manage to make them sit down on Sunday night, mostly because it's that, or there's usually some sort of costume drama or televised Dickens that I'm making them watch. And that's basically the time then that the four of us sit in there. But friends never come and sit in there. We hang out in the kitchen.
Yeah, it makes total sense. It's perfect for having people over, isn't it? Because your guests can be comfortable but connected to what you're doing at the same time.
Yeah, and one of us is usually cooking. I was exaggerating when I was saying I like to be on my own in the kitchen, not talking to anyone.
Well, you can't really be on your own.
No, you can't.
You?
It's a completely communal space.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing about, I think what I learn about my grandparents' home, that thing of horizontal space and actually the sort of subtle architecture of space using furniture. My grandmother was very good at that. And actually, our kids are growing older, and we're talking about in the next sort of few years, we'll think about moving.
What do they make of the house? Do they like it here?
They love our home.
Because you've talked actually very fondly about your own childhood home. How would you like them to remember this? Have you thought about that?
They're really proud of where we live, which I'm in turn really proud of. They really appreciate how lucky they are, and I don't know, they're relaxed in the space. I wasn't so relaxed in the space when I was growing up.
Why weren't you relaxed?
Well, just because my mum came home from work. She was completely exhausted. She would get home, she'd have to do the books, she'd probably bake a few cakes, and she'd be up at 5 the next morning. But she was really, it was the physical exertion of the business that she ran meant that the last thing that she wanted to do when she came home was come and clear up our mess. We definitely lived in an atmosphere of that tidiness equated to calm for her. And that can be quite intimidating and quite suffocating. So we're really careful about that with our own kids. I think it's really important actually that the space works. You're able to, it functions as a space. I know that's such a tired expression in design, but yeah, it's like that old piece of paisley that's over there. Just that kind of stuff is, it's just really important part of our home. Like having old chairs that aren't like the perfect chair is the story behind it, or just like the feeling that it gives is just like a bit of wrongness. Bad taste, good taste is, that gets my pulse going.
Exactly right. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm really interested in the idea of people's rituals within their home. Are you quite ritualistic about the way that you use it through the day? There's certain things that you do here at different times. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I love rituals. I think rituals are like a sort of part of what it makes us to be human beings, whatever that may be, whatever that ritual may be. I mean, we have dinner together on a Sunday night. We have dinner early on a Sunday night.
Will you cook it?
Usually Matthew cooks it.
What's that Sunday night ritual about?
It's about providing a space to just chat about the week ahead, do the things that we can't be bothered to do in the evening. Who's going to take Vita to school tomorrow morning, and troubleshooting really. So it has a kind of purpose. Tea, a cup of tea outside on our own before the children wake up on a Saturday morning. They're not complicated things. They're just moments of quiet. And because we, all of us tend to, when we start, that's it. We don't stop until the day's, I wish we could live like people in Italy live, like just have a little kind of afternoon nap. That was the great thing about breaking your hip. You've got license, like permission to do all of that stuff. Proper kind of napping, afternoon napping daily. And actually it's so restorative.
How do you make sure that you don't, after that experience, that restoration that you had for yourself when you're forced to be in bed a lot of the time, how do you make sure that you don't just go back to the way things were? How do you carry some of that through with you?
I think it's really, it's just like the question that that's what everybody was talking about. After lockdown, it's quite difficult not to revert to, especially when you've got priorities and commitments that require a certain way of being and working and a finite amount of time in the day to do those things. But actually, I think just doing things just sort of 70% less quickly, 70% less perfectly is a really good baseline, yeah.
Are you a perfectionist, naturally?
Probably. I think it's very limiting. It's had its uses, particularly in my work life, but actually it's sort of partly symptomatic, I think, of when we don't have actually, I think it's indicative of low self-esteem, to be honest. I think we're not supposed to be perfect, and actually there's great freedom in leaving stuff a bit fucked up and leaving just buildings that are left, front doors that aren't perfectly painted. We've had the undercoat left on our house for weeks, and it's that Matthew's saying that thing of, I must paint the front door, and I was like, no, just leave it actually. Yeah, it's not how I would describe myself, but there is a kind of, there's an appreciation for attention to detail, and also there's a sort of way in which I've just operated and practiced operating in a work context of, in a sort of broad sense and also in a kind of very granular sense, where I will do something and then reduce, whether it's like editing a film or editing a series of pictures or a piece of copy or just even refining an idea, that process of elimination, of honing, of refining, of reducing. That's just something that I've just done forever. I just do it instinctively without, I just don't really think about it. And actually it's really useful tool. The sort of perfectionism which comes with the procrastination often happens when, I guess you could say that procrastinating over, you know, a work project is, there's an element of fear, or I think it's the fear of not doing the thing or not doing the podcast, doing the talk, doing the whatever it is, but it's the sort of anticipation of being exposed, which again, I think these are all very core human things and what it is to be human. So yes, there's an element of fear, but also procrastination, being a part of perfectionism, is useful because it just inadvertently allows your brain time to think. It creates a pause. And I found that really useful in the work that I've done in publishing over the years. So
yeah, same. I think sometimes when you procrastinate over something, the stars align without you meaning them to, I found. Just before we move on to talking about the future, one question I always ask everyone is, and it's a tricky one, but how would you summarise the importance of your home to you as a person, the importance of it in your life? Can you put that into words?
I just think it's an impossible thing to talk about without sounding totally cliched, but it is about family, it's about people ultimately. It's about feeling safe. It's about feeling safe to be the person that you want to be in your home, to be vulnerable, intimate, to take risks, to have a laugh, to have fun, to do the things that you like doing, to be with your kids, do the stuff that you like doing. Yeah, and wherever I've lived, I've felt like that. Even when those homes weren't ours and weren't decorated, they've always had that feeling. And I think that's about being with people who make you feel that way. It's a really woo-woo answer, isn't it?
It's a perfect answer. I agree with everything you said. Let's talk about the future. Where, if you could paint a picture of where you would love to see out your days, what sort of thing would it be?
Let's go from what it wouldn't be. It wouldn't have lots of stairs.
Yeah. Is that, but just to pick you up on that, would it not have lots of stairs just from a practical standpoint of not being able to get up the stairs because one's elderly, or because you just like the idea of living laterally?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah, both. I grew up in a flat. My grandparents lived in a bungalow. Then I got married and lived in houses with tons of stairs.
Why do we all do that?
Matthew lived in a flat too. It's crackers.
It is. It's our housing stock though, isn't it?
I think it's also endemic of that sort of culture of homemaking and pride of your home represents something about who you are, and I don't know. But I'd like to live on one or two floors, and I like the space being designed by furniture rather than walls, and an opportunity to decorate in that space. And it would, key thing is that it would be near water.
Why?
Because I love being in water, and I spend quite a lot of time in water, where both of us do, swimming, and there's nothing like putting your head fully submerged in water to sort of bring a bit of momentary sanity. I don't mind whether it's sea or lake. A long time ago, we went to a place called Vals in Switzerland, which is the home of the thermal baths and Peter Zumthor built. And it's an extraordinary place because it's a funny little kind of Swiss alpine village and with a really interesting story. So the people of Vals, the Valser people, there was a hotel there adjacent to a natural spring, and it was owned by a German dude, and they basically persuaded him to sell it to them. So it was a great sort of socio-economic, cultural experiment, really. A bit like reminiscent of how I grew up, that idea of community building. And they said, I know, we'll enlist the help of a local architect, Peter Zumthor. And so he built this extraordinary thermal baths, like a kind of Tetris of pools of water of different kind of temperatures, and just nuts, because you go in and it's got that brilliant sort of Swiss very municipal feel when you go through this quite crappy entrance. A bit like very kind of Alexei Brodovich, the idea of scale, just something really small and then large and not, and that feeling of something really unexpected. And you go in and it's totally breathtaking. It's about water, glass, brass and concrete. And you swim out from these series of pools, everything from that it's fetishistic in its kind of attention to detail, like handles and the changing rooms. Like, it's just so seductive, the handles on the doors and the way the shower comes out of the wall, the concealment of all the pipework, just everything is kind of refined. It's so innovative, but I hate that word, but it's everything works in such a kind of pleasing way and it's so satisfying. And then you swim through these various pools. And I love this about his architecture. There are pools of light. There's nothing more reassuring and relaxing than a pool of lamplight. Unfortunately, Matthew loves a sort of a bit of top light, but that's very much part of his Peter Zumthor's architecture. So there are slits with shafts of light that sort of create this very dappled effect. And then you swim out into these outdoor pools and you're right bang in front of the Alps and it's snowing and there's steam coming off the water. And I just think, you know, the stories behind the buildings that he makes, I don't think it's an accident that he was saying that, and I'm not comparing myself to Peter Zumthor, by the way, that kind of being on the outside, he wasn't classically trained as an architect. He was a carpenter. His dad wanted him to become a carpenter. So that sort of growing up in a domestic environment with carpentry, looking at his dad woodworking on his tiled kitchen floor, whatever it is that inspired him, is no accident in the idiosyncrasy of the buildings that he does. And I think going back to Fernvals, I think the committee were really in uproar about the length of time that it takes for him to complete a project. I just think it's going back to that kind of how you make a home. It's an unfinished thing. It's never finished. And I like that. But yes, it's that project combined with my grandparents' home, incredible garden with outside designed spaces to be in, as well as being that sort of idea of inside, outside and life coexisting between the two, and it being a kind of seamless integration of those two with water, and handles designed by Peter Zumthor.
You picked up my favourite thing because I'm obsessed with door furniture. So I'm really pleased about that. But no, I think it's really interesting the way you describe Peter Zumthor. I think it's you'd call it material intelligence, wouldn't you? It's that understanding of, it's an inherent understanding of materiality and texture and tactility.
Especially on a door, yeah. Especially on a door, because it's the thing that you're interacting with. It's physical touch with the building. It's like these doors. They were made by a father and son team, really lovely family-owned business, which also is part of the allure of working with those kinds of people. And what they're good at is crittle. What they're not good at is door handles. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong. Like, I like to have some, we talked about a bit of wrongness, but their door handles were crap. And so I didn't want a crap door handle. So I designed a good one and got it made.
Yeah, it's extreme, but I'm with you on that. The very first podcast that we recorded was with Rosa Park, Serial Magazine editor and founder, and we talked about door handles. And one of the things I've always loved is this Finnish architect called Juhani Palasma describes the door handle as the handshake of the building.
That's lovely.
And that's so it, isn't it?
Yeah.
This idea that it should offer you a friendly handshake, it shouldn't challenge you to a scuffle of some kind.
Yeah, you know? Leave you clammy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think that's such an evocative future home. And you described home being about people. So who would be with you in this environment? What would be the human connection for you?
My friends and anyone who's still alive in my family.
Yeah, exactly. And what about the kind of community around it? Do you like the idea of being quite isolated, or do you like would it, if you could put it somewhere, would you put it in a village or a town, or where would you put it?
Again, I just think, I don't want to make myself sound like a sort of old fart, but the older I get, the more important knowing my neighbours, and like, it's just nice knowing the people in your neighbourhood, just connects you to a place. So I think it's important, yeah, and close proximity to London.
Do you, in terms of how you feel about the future, are you someone that looks forward a lot, or are you very much as a day-by-day person?
I try to be day-by-day, but yeah, I do look to the future, and actually I'm quite excited by it. I'm like, so many people are sort of moaning about being 50. I think it's completely liberating. I'm wearing hearing aids. It's a new thing. I can see people's faces who can't hear. They're like, oh, maybe I can do that too. So I just think if we can embrace that and make it a little bit less scary and a little bit more fun, then I'm good with that.
Last question. When you're in your Peter Zumthor bungalow with a lovely garden and some water, and you look back over your life and everything that you've done and all of your experiences, what do you think will be the most important thing to you?
This is the moment where I say something that's a sort of legacy. What's going to give me most satisfaction? Anything that I wasn't entirely instrumental in. Just, it's not a design-related thing. I think it's a sort of, again, it's a, I just... It's about being a parent. Just thank God I made shit tons of mistakes, and which allows me to be a better mum to my kids. I'm really in that zone at the moment. My kids are teenagers, you know, it's pretty bumpy. They are like alien beings when they're teenage. You're not at that point yet, but it's coming your way, and it requires a massive amount of just ignoring, letting go, knowing when to be present, knowing what to prioritise, which battles to pick. And I think the satisfaction of knowing that we're doing the best that we can is enough.
Do you try to model the behaviour of getting things wrong and, as you say, making lots of mistakes? Do you think that's really important for a parent to show their children that?
I think it's critical. I think it's one of the most important things that we can do as a parent is show that we are not immortal, to show them that we fuck up and that it takes courage and humility to say we're sorry and then move along. And while exercising our inherent kind of ability to parent, which we all have. So there isn't a right way and a wrong way, but I definitely feel that, thank God, culturally, it's practiced more now. Like when I was growing up, the perception was that you'd done something wrong if you were saying sorry and that you were not leading by example. And that's just nonsense. Satisfaction doesn't, doesn't really come in material things, does it? It's not really about that. It's about, we always remember the sort of, the memories and the laughing and the fuck-ups, and that's what's important.
Yeah. It's been so interesting, and I could sit...
Waffle.
No, but I could sit here with you all day, I'll be honest. I could, because I've really enjoyed it, actually.
And it's, me too, thanks. That's such a lovely thing to say.
No, I have.
Thank you.
I have, and it, as well, it's, I don't underestimate, it's a very generous thing to do it in your home as well. But what a privilege, what a lovely place. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, as always. A reminder that we always post up some pictures on the Modern House website to accompany each episode, so you can find those at themodernhouse.com. If you haven't yet subscribed to the show, please do tap the follow button and you'll be alerted as and when new episodes get released. This podcast was produced by Hannah Phillips and edited by Oscar Crawford, with music by Father. Thank you all for being here, and talk to you on the next one. Bye for now.